This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Thanks, Lee. So I'll begin with a couple of observations, mostly I think for just in case there's somebody here who hasn't had a chance to read the paper three or four times. And then I will try to do that quickly so that we can get to a conversation about the paper. So a couple of observations. First one's not necessary, so if you disagree with it, which most of you will, then just file it away. But my observation, I think, when I started thinking about this topic, or maybe even when I was a first-year contract student, was that the rules that we tell people are true in contracts just never seem to be true in my real life. I'm maybe, starting from the end of my paper, infatuated with the sort of taxi and car service examples. I worked as a taxi driver for a while, and I breached contracts all the time, and people breached them all the time to me, and the fleet owner breached contracts all the time. And there was even some litigation, although probably you're thinking, oh, it's too small amount of money to litigate. There was just never, ever expectancy damages. And once in a while, there were stipulated damages. And I think it really got me thinking, well, why is it that in some industries, we never see the rule, or maybe many industries, that we claim? I mean, we've done a lot of construction in this law school. We have never seen expectancy damages come up with anything, though specific performance, a little bit here and there. Landlord-tenant, you know, if thousands and thousands of people, especially residential tenants, in landlord-tenant relationships. And as the paper describes, I mean, they all seem to think that the real rule of contracts in country after country, I might point out, and I've done extensive survey about this, the real rule, not written anywhere, seems to have become stipulated damages, even though the parties are violating every code provision of every country. They're not stipulating carefully. They're not saying this really is stipulated damages. They're just saying, yeah, like here's a $1,000 deposit. And then everybody seems to evolve towards this understanding that when I breach the contract and I don't show up to rent as a first year student or something, I lose that $1,000 whether or not they were able to re-rent the apartment. And in fact, if the landlord cannot re-rent the apartment, nobody ever thinks the landlord follows me halfway across the country and collects $12,000 for the 12 months of loss. There are small exceptions to this. And in commercial leases, there are a lot of exceptions to this, but fewer exceptions than you think if you try to look at the cases. So that was sort of my background observation. Again, agree or don't with it as you will. Now here's an observation that I want you to agree with, or if you don't, go argue with it. I start with an observation and then really make two points in this paper. So two very segregated points, I think. The observation is that let's go with the majority flow in the room here and say that our rule is expectancy damages, but that we mean that as a strict liability rule. We understand that there are some areas of fault. I like the expression, the pockets of fault that Eric used. I used to say pockets of strict liability in tort, so maybe I especially like that expression. So we think of it as a strict liability system with occasional pockets of fault. But whatever we think of that, I think we all agree that with respect to mitigation, I think even pre-breach mitigation, but let's just go with post-breach for now, especially with respect to post-breach mitigation, we all agree and the doctrine provides that that's a fault-based system. And indeed, we say reasonableness, you know, did you reasonably mitigate, you know, go back to the lease case, you know, if you breach the contract, the landlord doesn't get to just sue you for the lost profits, the landlord's got to show that, you know, he advertised the place and tried to find people and maybe adjusted the price. And in theory, at least, in theory anyway, we understand that in this contracts world of strict liability, there is a substantial pocket of fault that is in the area of mitigation. So given that observation, I really make two points in the paper. Point one, how should we think of stipulated damages? I use the word stipulated carefully because sometimes it's liquidated into money, sometimes it's stipulated into an action, sometimes it's stipulated by a warranty and no damages. I'm gonna, as you know from the paper, I want to call all of those stipulated damages. So observation one, one way to think about stipulated damages is that the parties not only have accepted or opted for strict liability with respect to breach. I mean, if we breach, the amount of damages will be as we stipulated in the contract. But what they're really doing, in a way, is taking away the fault in the mitigation determination. They're really saying, oh, I like strict liability so much that I want it to extend to the whole contract, both to breach and to mitigation afterwards. It's got its costs. After all, they have to ex ante assess what those damages will be rather than leaving it in the hands of a court. They have to do that both with respect to the breach and with respect to the mitigation. But I want to think of that as sort of super strict liability. You know, you stipulate damages, you're taking away one of those important pockets of fault in contract, namely the reasonableness of mitigation. So that's point one of the paper. And I have some examples. Point two in the paper is, I think in a way more startling, and you know, maybe better, maybe worse, I don't really know, but point two in the paper comes from reading a lot of cases and then saying, well, you know, I think it's fair to say that this damages rule in contract is either under-enforced. You could either think of it as courts just saying, well, yeah, we learned that in law school too. We just don't really want to do that rule. You know, case after case after case saying, well, it was too speculative, or was this, or was that, or we're not sure. You know, lots and lots of opting out of this damages rule. And one way to think about it from a law and economics perspective is that if parties wanted damages, if they don't like that opt-out rule, they can opt back in. They can get their damages normally by stipulating. That is one way to think of expectancy damages being under-enforced by courts, is that courts are pushing people to stipulate damages more often. Now that, you know, takes the world as we've learned it a little bit upside down. The usual claim to first-year students is, oh, stipulated damages, you know, tisk tisk, it's very risky because you get a little too high there and courts will say that's a penalty clause and, oh, they don't like that, that's like gambling, you know, that's very, very bad. You know, we don't do that, or that's anti-Holmes, you know, you can't have that. But I think, you know, at least as fair, maybe a fairer way to think about it, if you add up all the contracts out there, is that actually courts like stipulated damages a lot, and the way they show us that there is literature on why penalty damages might be, you know, better thrown out, and maybe parties misassessed and costs, I'm not going into that now, though it's footnoted in the paper. But just the simple idea that if you can't count on us to enforce a damages background rule of contracts, that might encourage you to stipulate damages more. You know, maybe just a today way of framing it, given the previous papers, is to say, when courts under-enforce expectancy damages, you could just think of that as courts opting for a negligence rule. I don't mean that they're doing something they shouldn't do. You could think of that however you want. But when the parties are encouraged or opt to stipulate damages, you can think of that as the party saying, well, thanks, but we prefer a strict liability rule. So they can choose, courts can choose whether they want a negligence or strict liability rule. Parties can choose whether they want a negligence or strict liability rule as well by opting for more or less stipulated damages. Now, as for the first point, that was the one that really stipulated damages introduces strict liability with respect to mitigation. You know, the first reaction to it might be, well, how could that be? I mean, we really want to know that we got reasonable mitigation. And the reaction, I think, should be, as I try to show with an extensive example in the paper, is that usually stipulated damages, as strict liability does in general, gives one party very, very good incentives to take reasonable and only reasonable mitigation. The example I use is of a big residential landlord. You breach your contract. You don't show up on September 1st to take over a one-year lease. Well, the landlord knows that the landlord will keep your, I call it in the paper, I think it was a $1,000 deposit or something. The landlord then has a really good incentive to advertise and go out and find other tenants. Much better incentive than if the landlord then had to share the gain with you or show what was reasonable, unreasonable. I mean, it's internalized very, very nicely. Now, a problem with that is that sometimes it's a comparative fault regime. Sometimes the other party really could help in a cooperative solution. For example, the other party maybe didn't have to wait till September 1st to say, oh, I'm not going to show up for my lease, and might have called, you know, mid-May and said, I have no intention of moving to Chicago and taking over that lease. And so I point out that if the parties want, they can do a little bit more detailed stipulation, and they can say, here's our stipulated damages of, you know, $1,000. And if you fail to inform us by August 1st that you'll be breaching, that you won't show up, then it'll be $2,200 and you can stipulate. Every law student that's thought of dropping out of law school, i.e. every law student has thought about this, because all these catalogs of universities say specifically, if you don't show up on the first day, here's how much of your tuition you owe us. If you leave a week later, you owe us that money. If you let us know by July 1st, we can go to the waiting list and get somebody. That is, the university is almost surely the master of mitigation in finding somebody else to fill the spot in the class, but there's some help that the student can give, and the contract, the stipulated damages, go along with that. And then as for point two, that was the point about what the real rule is, if you will. I remind you of the obvious point we all learned, and then add a point to it. The obvious point is that stipulated damages have a kind of knowledge advantages, right? We who bargain might know more about our likely damages even in advance than a court would know even with its advantage of hindsight. So we might not think they'll be very good at assessing damages later on after breach. We might think we can do better now, and that I think is a good conventional explanation of why we might stipulate damages. And then the second piece of it, as you now know from my description or from the paper, is that, well, when we stipulate damages, it's true that we lose some of our comparative fault advantages about mitigation, but one way to think about it is that we are trying to take away from ourselves, we're pre-committing not to litigate over mitigation. And maybe the places where we see the stipulated damages the most would be exactly those places where we fear that we will have a tough time and courts will have an even tougher time trying to figure out what reasonable mitigation was. One could be a little bit puzzled by the bundling. Why, when you stipulate damages, do you have to get both that knowledge and no litigation at once? I give some examples about how parties themselves could unbundle it. We could sign a contract that says, I gave two examples in the paper, I don't know that I need to repeat them, but it's, you know, we stipulate damages, but we agree to go to an arbitrator if you fail to inform me by August 1st of something. I mean, that there are ways to unbundle those, though normally they're bundled. And I do those through those two cases, the well-known Dempsey boxing case and then one of those seemingly odd burglar and fire alarm cases, for those who read the paper, to try to show ways in which you could have one of those advantages, the knowledge, or avoiding litigation over mitigation, or you could have both, or you could have one. So to summarize, because I just can't bear to have Lee say, do you want to wrap up? To summarize, I would say, you know, this is mostly or entirely a positive paper. I like positive papers. It's a positive paper in a lot of ways. It tries to show how stipulated damages are really being used, how they really form a strict liability core and all that. Maybe even casts a lot of light on those cases that I at least found puzzling when I first came to the world of law. Even my trivial taxi case, much less the residential cases. I think the way I look back on those taxi cases now, found at the very end of the paper, if you want to read them, all the cases where I call the taxi doesn't show up and I miss my flight at O'Hare, or I call the taxi, I don't show up, I take a ride with somebody else, the taxi driver shows up and it's furious, 5 a.m, waiting outside my house and I don't show up. None of those cases do we find damages or their equivalent in larger commercial settings. And one way to think about them in retrospect is, those are cases where litigating about mitigation would be very, very hard. They are outrageously fault cases. I mean, it's so easy for the taxi cab company to call me or me to call a company and say, you know, I'm taking a ride with a friend, so don't bother driving all the way down here to pick me up. I'm not going to be there. It's so easy for them to say, you know, our guy really isn't going to show up, so don't wait there with all this anxiety outside your house. Just grab a ride. I mean, very, very rare for either party to do that, but you can imagine if we had to litigate over who could have mitigated and when they could have called and how much. You can imagine how hard that fact-finding would be. Therefore, I like the idea that there's no expectancy damages, and when we want to stipulate, we do. I have one car service that stipulates. Some of us call restaurants that say, give us your credit card. You lose $50 if you don't show up. That is, the world has moved towards a little bit of stipulation, exactly as I think we would have predicted. Please.
Richard.
No, Richard, my experience with Richard is he always gets called on first.
All right. Yeah. So, I wonder about the idea of committing not to litigate mitigation. I think that when they're liquidated or stipulated damages, people don't typically. But I think your footnote 8 quotes the UCC as saying the liquidated damage clause is not exclusive unless it clearly is exclusive. And that's common law. There are huge numbers of liquidated damage clauses that are, I've never seen a liquidated damage clause that claims to be exclusive. What you'd expect, an exclusive liquidated damage clause would be an already performance. I would either drive you to the airport or give you $50. But when you have liquidated damage clauses, I'm not precluded.
Well, you want to say liquidated as opposed to stipulated?
I understand liquidated as opposed to.
Well, I don't know what that means, because to me they're all part of the same picture.
Okay, they're
so repair or replace says it's exclusive.
A liquidated damage clause seldom says it's exclusive. and
lots okay.
of cases
find okay.
it or not.
Even though it should.
No. I think parties don't want it to be.
Okay, so I bounce a check in my dry cleaner. What do you want to do with that example? Big sign, $25. But it doesn't say exclusive. No.
If he wants to sue you for his actual damages, he can't. I think it's not worth it.
I don't think you could show me a case in the entire universe where he collects damages.
I can show you lots of real estate cases.
No, I
think he has it's a low
you accepted
stakes.
That we were going to do that case.
Oh, I think it's a low case, a low stakes.
Okay.
Because he could easily
right.
commit to being exclusive.
It's not always a low case, as we all know when people have bounced checks against us.
High cases where they are
yeah.
committed, and they're not exclusive.
What would you do, and where are you on the real estate one? So I think
there
I actually
there are a lot of real estate cases.
How about the
residential
real estate?
Sales of residential real estate
no.
are often
let's do the rent. But I
want
to do
know the answer.
But let's do the rental real estate. Because again, it's a fair amount of money. These people litigate all the time over the damage deposit. I mean, unbelievable. I've been a landlord, I've been a tenant. Everyone's litigating over, no, I did not paint this. And you know, they're not embarrassed to threaten or go to small claims court over $185. You gotta have some explanation for me about why they accept the $1,000.
I suppose it's a cost of litigation, but I'm wondering
But then why do they?
I'm wondering about your explanation is why don't they put in the contract this is exclusive?
Well, okay, so that's why I said that seems to be the focus, which is, right, okay, so let's focus on that. Well, again, by my lights, they often do put it in the contract because I don't see why liquidation is different from other stipulations. So in the world of stipulated damages, it happens often to be listed as exclusive. Okay, but if we go with the liquidated damages one, part of it is, and this is common in other legal systems, sometimes they want it to be a minimum and they want to be able to go higher. Sometimes they want it to be a maximum and they want to go lower. Sometimes I think they correctly see that the law doesn't mean what it says, that practice will be that you're limited to your stipulated damages. But I have no objection if they want to go ahead and put it. I'm a positive kind of guy. It's sort of like my puzzle at the very end. What do I make of the fact that in the taxi case, so few people stipulate? It's not just that they don't say it's exclusive. They don't stipulate at all. We can try to mosey around and come up with explanations, but it would be fine with me if they wrote exclusive remedy much more often. I don't think it really hurts or helps my two theses that they don't stipulate that way. Do you see what I mean?
No, because...
Okay, wait, and I want to give one more case. What do you do with the burglar alarm case? That's liquidated damages, and I do say exclusive. Right? And I do talk about that at some length. So I bet I could find many more. I'm not good at it.
There are cases where they do.
Okay, you said never. But you did say never. But I mean, so what we find is what we'd expect. A lot of times they say it's exclusive, and a lot of times they don't say it's exclusive. How could that be possible?
Well, I guess what's puzzling is that when it's not exclusive, it's not forming a pre-commitment not to litigate mitigation story. In fact,
great, because those are the cases maybe where it's about knowledge.
Okay.
See, I want to have it both ways. It would be puzzling to me if it was always about knowledge or always about not litigating. See, I want it to be about sometimes both, sometimes one, sometimes the other. My guess in the paper is that it's probably rare that it's both. Okay, and that's what I meant by the Dempsey versus the burglar law. But I will try to include in the paper more discussion of where it's exclusive, because now I am a little nervous about that. Okay.
So you say that when there is liquidated damages, I know that you are talking about stipulated, but liquidated is one major example, right? So if there is liquidated damages, you say it's a super strict liability. Now, in one sense, it may be right, but on the other end, remember that when courts decide whether to strike down a liquidated damages clause as a penalty, actually there are two considerations. The first one is the actual harm, and the second one is the expected harm when the parties liquidated the damages. Now, I would suspect, it's a positive matter, and also as a normative matter, that when courts decide what was the court decide what was the expected damages, probably they would also take into account mitigation. In other words, right? So suppose that your harm is 1,000, but if you mitigate it, it would be just 100. I would suspect that many courts would say the expected harm is 100, not 1,000, and therefore you wouldn't be able to collect the liquidated damages if it's much higher than that. So what I'm saying is that in a way, even when you have liquidated damages, it's very hard to escape, well, for courts, to escape the question of what was reasonable to do to mitigate, because it's part of the question of what is the expected harm.
That doesn't trouble me. I don't know if you think it should trouble me or not. It doesn't trouble me. I take the question to mean there is also this topic that I recognize, but I'm not trying to make the centerpiece of my paper, about what to make of the penalty damage rule and its uneven application. And as you know better than I, there's a lot of very interesting literature, very sophisticated law and economics literature. Some, freedom of contract libertarian, you should never, ever second guess the parties, and a lot of it, very sophisticated, by people who otherwise love contracts, that says, no, a lot of times it's actually clever ex post to occasionally second guess parties because they erred and all that, and you can save a lot of moral hazards and all that. So I'm happy to have that world. And I think you're right on the margin. That is, meaning on the margin, it might be that a few more cases will fall into that gray area where parties have to be nervous that it'll be regarded as a penalty, because courts will take the mitigation into account. That's okay with me.
No, but therefore, parties would mitigate, right? Because
Meaning there's a trade-off. They might be better off, they might be worse off. I don't know, I really don't have an opinion on whether that makes the world a better
or
worse place.
The only thing I would say is that it's not that I don't agree that, I think you're right, it's a kind of a strict liability, a super strict liability. The only thing I say is that I'm not sure that the parties would be able to escape, or the courts would have, be able to escape the question of what was reasonable to do under those circumstances. Not necessarily whether, in fact, the parties reasonably mitigated,
right,
but what would be reasonable to do the expected harm is too high.
I don't think you're really arguing that far. I think you're saying it can't be that in every single case the possibility of mitigation will shove it over the line into a penalty. It's just that at the margin there'll be some cases that'll make it run that high, that'll take it over. There'll be a lot of other cases. All the repair or replace cases, all the burglar alarm cases, where the parties have been very, very successful avoiding mitigation litigation. Even though it's obvious, when I come in with my broken camera, that I might have had a lot to do with why it's broken. When it's obvious that when my house is stolen, things are stolen out of my house, that I might have taken better care to keep the doors closed or not give out the burglar alarm code to a lot of people. There's lots and lots of that in these cases. And courts have avoided litigation over all this quite successfully. And again, I don't want to be a Bob Scott or somebody who always insists that the parties bargaining 5 years ago always got right what ought to happen now. There's costs and benefits to keeping them to their contract. And I'm just being positive about this. Anybody we haven't heard from yet, or I'm happy to go? Eric, and then Richard.
Not sure. So is your argument that the courts deliberately award expectation damages lower than what's optimal in order to encourage the parties to stipulate so that the courts don't have to make this mitigation decision? Is that right?
No. I think it's plausible that they do. I don't claim to know what they're intending to do. Well, I'm observing that many, many times they either, let's just take the extreme case, that many, many times they don't give expectancy damages, even though we think they could have calculated something close to them. And one thing that we can see about those cases is that knowing that will happen, knowing that there are those courts out there, that itself might encourage people to stipulate more often. So that if we are asking what courts do, whether courts really just, if someone comes, a client comes to me and says, should I stipulate damages in advance? And here's all the pluses and minuses. It used to be that I would think, you got to be careful about stipulating, because if you stipulate too high, you stipulate too low, you might be sorry and cause breach, and if you stipulate too high, they might throw it out. Now I need to think, if you don't stipulate damages, you're leaving it to court to award expectancy damages, and a lot of times they won't award expectancy damages. They'll say too speculative, or they'll say this, or they'll say that. That itself might mean that you'd be better off stipulating damages. That's my claim. I don't know what they intend. I'll sound like you by saying, I don't know what intent means.
What was the connection between that claim and the point about mitigation?
Yeah. They are, as I say, they are segregated claims. They're separate claims.
So what's the mitigation argument?
The mitigation argument is that when the parties stipulate damages, one of the things we could think of them as doing is deciding not to litigate over mitigation. So they're choosing a strict liability rule about mitigation. That is that part of contract law that I think we all agree was fault-based. And then the secondary point was, and don't think that means they gave up on mitigation, because one party might internalize the mitigation incentive pretty well, or they can stipulate in some detail, like naming dates, to encourage the stipulation to follow mitigation.
Okay, I was mixing them together, but with respect to the first one, I mean, is that a new idea? It just seems to me that...
Which one are we on now? The expectancy damages causing people to stipulate?
The doctrine has been that if there are difficulties and problems in proof, the court is going to, of course, liquidate damages as long as there are, reasonable estimate or a reasonable amount of the actual loss. So why wouldn't people...
Well, fair enough. I think what's new about it is that we leave ourselves, and certainly every treatise and casebook leaves us with the impression that stipulating is dangerous without recognizing the second step, which maybe I make too quickly, that, when they throw out your stipulation, when they say it's a penalty clause, that's not the end of the case. You then revert back to expectancy damages. So the cost of having our stipulation thrown out is just that we go back to the expectancy damage rule. Whereas the cost of not stipulating and going with expectancy damages and having the court say it's too speculative is that we end up with no damages. And I think that really changes the calculus of whether we should think of courts as favoring or disfavoring stipulation. That, I think, is original.
I guess so. But it doesn't matter whether we think of courts as...
Well, it matters in terms of the advice we give people. Yeah, we train students and say to them, or think ourselves the role of stipulation. I went into this project thinking that stipulation was discouraged. That's what all the literature says.
No.
Okay,
no,
that's what all the literature says.
I mean,
we'll get your turn in a minute, Richard.
I don't know what other people do, but the casebook sort of encourages this, is you teach liquidated damages right after you teach the speculative loss stuff.
Yes.
So you get all these cases where people are not recovering, and then the students get upset about this, and then you can say, well, go ahead and...
Yes, let me just correct, not just to anticipate Richard's question, but I think we have the impression correctly that law encourages low stipulations. It likes waivers and the warranty and replace or repair.
They have to be accurate. If they're low, they can be set down.
Very, very rare.
Oh, yeah.
Very rare.
I don't think that's
repair or replace?
I think the burglar alarm case, I just...
Oh, there's only one other, there's only one case I could find.
There's only one case like that.
One case. I brought my research assistant as a witness. And ironically, it's the one people shove into the case book. Yeah, of course. Spoken as a best-selling author. The standard rule is, and I give you some of the cases, and Elizabeth Warren gathers some of them, and you just search high and low, and people do continue litigating them to effect, but the stipulation stands up pretty well. Richard, I promise.
On the originality point, I think the claim is right, but I think 20 years ago when I wrote the paper called Beyond Foreseeability, we made the identical argument that essentially what happens is if you have a system where you know what maximization is, and you know at the front end that all the mitigation lies on one part, and the optimal strategy is to have a fixed payment and then no mitigation rule, because you'll get the optimal level of mitigation. But that's one point. The second point is, I think it's very important when you make this argument to understand the context in which it does or does not apply. And what you're doing is kind of generalizing from situations without noticing their litigation, their limitations. So for example, in the lease type situation, what happens is if in fact the tenant does not show up, everybody goes their separate ways, and this strategy works rather well. But if you take something like we were talking about before, which is the continuous construction contract, at that point a completely different body of rules take over. It's the major minor breach rules that take over. And what happens in all of these situations is that minor breaches tend to lead to interim damages, which lead to correction and contract continuation. And the way that this is done is not through litigation, it's done through construction contract oversight. So the typical way in which it happens is you got a year project, every week they meet, they figure out what the screw-ups are, they then figure out what the mitigation strategy is, and then they figure out what the offsets are, and they continue to go on. So, under those cases, You can't use this fixed-sum strategy because you can't possibly survive simply abandoning the contract and you change the sort of structure. So all I would say on that point is if you want to do with this thing is beware of the kinds of examples you use so that you don't generalize the contract law, but you do generalize only to certain kinds of contracts where there's total severance after breach as opposed to continuous multiple breach type situation.
Okay, a couple of comments, one flattering, one self-serving. Which one do you want first?
Well, let's have self-serving first.
Self-serving, you have too many papers for you to read the footnotes, but I talk a lot about the construction one, where I think the context is even more subtle than you're describing, because I suggest that the argument is pushed over to the battle among sureties. That is, I will want a performance bond, and you'll want a surety, and we need to look at how litigation carries out. No, but I think... Okay, I think that, it's also about the time, but I think that carries over to that because it turns it into yet more strict liability and so forth. And now, maybe you don't deserve the flattering if you're not going to agree with my self-serving. but as for the flattering one, I'm glad to know that you wrote that 20 years ago, and I'll go look at it again. Though I think my point is a little bit different, and it's a great paper, Richard. But my point's a little different because I'm suggesting that it's true even where we don't have the knowledge and even where both of us are needed to mitigate. That is, it still might pay for us to avoid litigation later.
I would guarantee those are 9 to 10 cases. For example, in some of the limo cases now, they do take the card. Yeah. The standard rule is if you don't show, you pay the full thing and there's no litigation for full price.
I think the residential landlord case is really a striking case where maybe it's 9 to 10, but I don't even know which direction. I mean, I don't show up to take my apartment. Sometimes they are really the better mitigator, and sometimes I'm really the better mitigator by having given further advance notice. You know, I think the rule is really kind of cool. And the stipulated damages do a good job, and courts would be very bad later on at figuring out what...
The breaching tenant can't sublease is the key point, and so therefore...
But the breaching tenant, even where that's true, unlike the commercial case... The breaching tenant can give further advance notice.
That's a second order effect.
Really?
Because by definition, he hasn't shown up with or without notice. He isn't there on the day the lease starts. And you've got enough in the thing so that you get at least a month's free rent. So I think it's...
But you might have liked finding tenants a month earlier.
Well, I mean, it may be. I did talk about this in my paper, which was the seasonalness.
Yeah.
You bring something to harvest. And it's just early or late to get interest in.
Okay.
But it turns out you miss a market when you
do. Cal, that's great. All right, I need to look at that.
So
Sean.
Yeah, I want to go over the taxi example.
Taxi?
Yeah. I'm a little confused about how the focus on mitigation makes it two ways. The first is, I don't understand what's so hard to figure out about whether or not the taxi driver mitigates if I don't show up. So there's not that much information we need. Did any calls come into the dispatcher?
No, I'm sorry. Who do you have breaching in this example?
Right. So the first one, I'm the customer and I breach.
Okay.
So now the question is, you say if we focus on the difficulty of mitigation, it explains the fact that expectancy damage
right.
is
so
available.
You,
but it's not that difficult really to figure out whether the taxi driver mitigated. We can find out, were there calls to the dispatcher in the relevant time? Did the taxi driver drive down the normal streets where one picks up fares? Two questions, not that.
How are we going to find that out? Or did go to O'Hare and wait in line? How long would the line have been? How are you going to find that out? But it'll be very hard to verify. The verification seems almost impossible.
Well, look, maybe this is getting too into the details of taxi driving.
No, there's no such thing.
Right, because I've got a whole thing I need to talk to you about taxis later. But taxi drivers are often in pretty constant contact with their dispatchers. So it's not actually that difficult to figure this out.
Okay.
My
experience was that it was very difficult, but okay.
And
similarly in the other side of the transaction.
Let me ask you about the other side.
That must be easier for me. Right?
Yes, that is easier
okay.
for you. Though,
thank you.
In limited periods of time,
right.
when people are rushing to airports, there's not that much you can do. But the question I was wondering about with respect to the other side of it, where the taxi driver doesn't show up for me, is let's suppose you're right, but it's difficult to tell whether I could have mitigated. But on the other hand, it's really difficult for me to stipulate. If I'm a repeat customer, maybe I'll find a car service that will stipulate with me. But But in most cases, I can't.
Right.
I can't bargain to the stipulation. So there are huge transaction costs in assessing mitigation. Let's just take your view about that on board. But there are also enormous costs to even try to stipulate. It may not be available. Why is it going to eliminate the lack of expectancy damages that instead of mitigation, I could have stipulated when in fact I couldn't have stipulated?
Right. That's great. It's not only fair, but that's a great point. I guess what I should say is, it won't solve the problem, and I'm not claiming that stipulation always solves the problem, but what's noteworthy is that if we stick with expectancy damages, fact-finding is so difficult that that won't solve the problem either. So it's not a panacea, but I think the verifiability is so hard that it won't solve the problem that way. But that would have been a much better way for me to frame it.
And do you think if the verifiability is less difficult with mitigation than it is to engage in stipulation activities, that's a better reason to return to expectancy damages?
I don't know. I think it's close. I'm not really sure. I mean, the restaurant case is another one that's close. I don't know.
Now, just as a factual question, it seems like your paper assumes that there's not all that much ex post scrutiny of the amount of liquidated damages in practice, that the law sort of on the books, like 2718, isn't really applied. You really don't have to show it was a genuine attempt to pre-estimate damages or bear some logical relation to the actual harm when the case is in court. Is that an assumption of your paper, or are you relying on people's perception of this to stop the suits from coming forward in the first place?
Okay, well, again, first, I think I'm sympathetic to the question. Let me just restate a little bit. So the law is either or, right? I mean, either show that it turned out to be a good estimate or show that ex ante it was a good estimate.
What I'm saying is that...
Right? So it's a little broader about what courts would have to look at.
Yeah, the court does have more flexibility, but I thought you were suggesting that the court wants to avoid making the expectancy type of calculation for some reason, whatever it is. Therefore, it wants to give an incentive. You said that they...
No, I clearly said I'm not into what courts are intending here.
No, but with Eric, didn't you say that?
I'm just saying that is what they end up doing, whether they're trying to do that or not. I don't have an opinion.
Oh, I thought you were saying, Eric, that because courts prefer people to stipulate, they keep expectation damages low to create an incentive to stipulate.
No. I don't want to put it as causality. Well, let's just take the famous first-year contracts case that I put in the paper of Dempsey. The standard way that 1L contract teachers make fun of the case is, again, the court says, well, your lost profits from not having a boxing match. That's just so speculative, And the standard way to make fun of the case is, why is it any more speculative than, 99% of the other damage determinations courts make? I mean, venture capitalists would think that was pretty easy compared to other things. This is the regular business we're in when we ascertain damages. It's no more or less speculative than what are your injuries when I kick you. We do this all the time about business, about torts and all that. So I don't know that it's really so hard. I think that's, they can think whatever they want. I think it's more, think about what they're doing. They're rebounding to the parties. Whether or not this is why they're doing it, it ends up rebounding to the parties this advantage of stipulation.
Right, but then it rebounds to the court almost the very same inquiry.
No, right. So the answer to your first question in my world is no. The courts are quite generous. They draw a much bigger circle around it, and if the estimations as represented in the stipulated damages are anywhere close to reasonable, fine.
So they hear the same evidence and make the same inquiry, but they have much greater latitude in what they do as the claim.
Well, and often people don't even bring the claim to say that it was too high. And
right, that I acknowledge as a strength.
The actual number of cases where people are saying, where it's held as too much of a penalty, and the actual number of cases of industries where it seems to us that people are chilled because of the sphere of penalty actually strikes me as quite small. I think we way overemphasize that in our doctrinal view of contract law compared to this flip side.
Thank you, Saul.
Thank you.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.